This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Native Americans and their allies reject the celebration of genocide that some call Thanksgiving. Dr. Gerald Horn predicts Donald Trump may bring the capitalist system to an even quicker end. And Diana Johnstone says the parties of the left and the right have switched positions on both sides of the Atlantic.
But first, Donald Trump has had little to say about what he'll do to Medicare, but lots of Republicans in Congress would like to put the nation's premier health care program on the chopping block. Nancy Altman is co-director of Social Security Works. She says the same people that are trying to privatize Social Security also have plans to change Medicare.
Unfortunately, the plans are not good ones. And actually, we now have a little bit more information about Donald Trump as well. The Republicans have never really liked Social Security or Medicare. They are programs that work, and they completely go against the Republican ideology that the private sector is always better. Medicare works wonderfully. It provides excellent insurance for people 65 and over and people with disabilities. And it does so more efficiently, even though seniors and people with disabilities have the highest medical costs. Medicare provides them insurance more efficiently on a per capita basis than you can find in the private sector. So it's a program that works. It's a program people really appreciate. But the crazy thing is that the Republicans want to privatize it. They want to turn over all that money, give seniors and people with disabilities simply a subsidy, a check, and say, good luck, go out and get private insurance. The problem is that before Medicare was enacted in 1965, most seniors couldn't even get insurance. And if they could get insurance, they paid astronomical amounts for it. So this is really turning the clock back.
One would think that they would have learned their lesson after George Bush made his assault on Social Security back in the early 2000s.
That's right. You would think so, but they unfortunately have learned some bad lessons from that. One is to do it in the dead of night so that people don't know that it's happening. With George Bush, as bad as his effort to privatize Social Security was, he went around the country talking about it. And of course, the more he talked, the less popular it became as people understood it. This one, they're talking perhaps as soon as January, but certainly in the next 7 or 8 months, sneaking it into a bill called reconciliation, where the Democrats will not be able to filibuster it in the Senate because it's under special rules. It'll be part of a bigger bill, and nobody will know about it until it happens. And the other thing that they're doing, in addition to doing it under dead of night, they are telling a real lie, which is they're saying we have to do it because of Obamacare. You know, they've been talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act. That is something that they may do, but they are saying, but we have to go after Medicare because the Obamacare really hurt Medicare, which is, as I say, a lie. The Affordable Care Act didn't have a lot of provisions about Medicare, but the ones that were there strengthened Medicare, provided additional benefits. So this is trying to use the unpopularity of Obamacare to undermine Medicare.
And of course, you and others say that the way to fix what's wrong with Obamacare is to give everybody Medicare, Medicare for all.
Absolutely. In fact, our nation spends about twice what other countries spend on health care, and our infant mortality rate and mortality, lots of our measures are not as good as other countries. And other countries have what is, in essence, Medicare for all. The people who created Medicare expected that to be a first step. They were talking about putting in Medikids after that and just closing the age. And it is as important as the Affordable Care Act was and is, it is inferior to simply putting everybody under Medicare. But the Republicans are dead set about not only getting rid of Obamacare, but getting rid of Medicare. And another lie they are going to say, not only will people not know about it, but when people raise objections, they will say, we're saving it. They're not saving it. They're seeking to dismantle it.
But lots of Democrats, and I'm speaking specifically of those around Hillary Clinton, are also not proponents of single-payer Medicare for all.
You know, it's interesting. Senator Sanders was a strong proponent of Medicare for all, and he made a lot of sense for it. And a lot of the Clinton advocates, because he was doing so well in the polls, I thought it was a real mistake. They went after, he had very, very good proposals. One of them was Medicare for all. And there were a number of journalists and analysts and supporters of Clinton that came out against it. I think that was outrageous, quite frankly. And I think that if they were being honest, I don't know for sure, but I would hope that they would see the wisdom of Medicare for all. I think in this case, I'm hoping, and Minority Leader Pelosi has said that they are going to be against these Medicare changes. So I hope that's true. Donald Trump ran on not cutting Medicare, but just the other day, his spokesperson said, well, he would consider some alternatives. So I'm afraid Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House, who has Donald Trump's ear, is selling him. I think probably Donald Trump doesn't really care, and Paul Ryan cares fiercely. We still, despite the last election, Medicare is extremely popular, not only among Democrats, but among Republicans, people who supported Donald Trump. And this is not what they voted for. They did not vote on destroying Medicare. But that's what they're going to get this first year if we don't stand up and make a lot of noise.
Well, the political complexion of Donald Trump's cabinet as it's shaping up might have something to do with whatever position he finally takes on Medicare and on Social Security.
Oh, and it's really frightening. He's already named his transition team for the Social Security Administration. And you would not believe it. It is full of people who have for decades been advocating privatizing Social Security. So they're going to squeeze the agency. People are going to start having their offices, their field offices, their local Social Security Administration offices, which they have paid for, because you pay for that every time you pay into Social Security. They're going to have those cut way back. And you are exactly right. I would bet that whoever becomes Secretary of Health and Human Services is going to be someone who's against Medicare. So Donald Trump said what he had to say to get elected, but I don't believe that's really the position. I hope it is, but I would be shocked. And all the signals now coming out from Paul Ryan, from Donald Trump's spokespeople, and from the people he's got surrounding himself with, including his vice president, are all, they hate Medicare, they hate Social Security. They'll tell you they love it. They'll tell you we can't afford it. But that is not true. We are the wealthiest nation in the world at the wealthiest moment in our history. There is no question we can afford these programs as long as Donald Trump and his billionaire friends pay more. And that's something they don't want to do.
And there are a number of progressive voices who say that the correct response to Donald Trump's election, a political response rather than an emotional or mourning response, is to go whole hog offensively for a single payer system.
I think that would be wonderful. That would be really a phoenix rising out of the ashes. As much as I was a supporter of President Obama, I think he made a mistake in not pushing this. I think the Republicans would have, in fear, you know, come up with what he did come up with. He was really trying to hand an olive leaf, an olive branch to the Republicans. It's really a basic Republican idea to use the private marketplace. We should have built on Medicare, but the last thing we should be doing is turning Medicare into privatizing it, into the handing it over to the private sector. So I think that that would be wonderful. It would also be unbelievably popular. As divided as our country is over many issues, we are not divided over Social Security and Medicare. Every segment of the population, whether you're Republican, Democrat, whether you're a Tea Party, or whether you have a union member in the household, whether you're young, whether you're old, they all, people overwhelmingly say that both Social Security and Medicare are more important than ever. They understand the value of it, and they would like to see them expanded, not cut. And we should definitely be lowering the Medicare age at least to 62 when you can first get Social Security. But I would lower it to 55, ultimately with the idea of covering everyone.
Yes, a lot of progressives who went along with Obamacare justified their actions by saying that it was a step towards single payer. But the real step towards single payer would have been, as you say, lowering the age for Medicare and establishing that direction for the future.
Exactly. You know, the for-profit insurance companies and the drug companies are never going to welcome restrictions, but that's why you have to have a program that you can understand. Obamacare throws us all into the arms of the for-profit insurance companies. The nice thing about Medicare is the money goes to the government, and it really is a system that works. There are so many people who are just hanging on until they can reach 65. They would be thrilled if the age got lowered to 62. It would be overwhelmingly popular and everybody would understand it and their families would be thrilled. So the Democrats missed a real opportunity, but I hope they now jump on the bandwagon of Medicare for all.
That was Nancy Altman of Social Security Works in Washington.
No constituency was more opposed to Donald Trump's bid for the White House than black people. A storm of controversy is swirling around the role that so-called identity politics played in the Democrats' loss. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and one of Black America's most prolific authors.
First of all, I think history is useful in terms of a polemic that has erupted that suggests that the reason that Donald Trump won was because of, quote, attention to identity politics, unquote. That is to say, that's never specifically defined, but as you tease out the rhetoric, it appears to suggest that organizations like Black Lives Matter is identity politics, and people protest against being shot down in the streets by officers of the state. That's identity politics. And apparently the, quote, white working class, unquote, and the white middle class object to that, and they rebel to allege Democratic Party attention to so-called identity politics and vote for Donald J. Trump. Now, I mean, there's so much wrong with that analysis, I'm not even sure where to start. I mean, first of all, I always thought that we were supposed to speak of the working class, and if you're speaking of the white working class, the emphasis is on white. And to try to smuggle working class into whiteness, I think, is bankrupt at best. Second of all, I think it turns reality on its head. That is to say, the black women who voted at a higher rate than any other group against Donald J. Trump become chumps. And the white folks who voted for him seem like visionaries, since they rebelled against neoliberalism and all the rest. I think that this Donald J. Trump election, the only good news you can say is that Donald J. Trump will probably prove to be the Gorbachev of the United States of America. That is to say, he was elected by this white majority to restore, or as they say, make America great again, to take it back to the halcyon days of the 1950s, when, of course, we were subjected to apartheid. But in fact, I think he'll accelerate the decline of U.S. imperialism and of white supremacy. The good news for those who voted for Donald J. Trump is that the Netherlands has been in decline for 300 years, and for many people, it's still a pleasant place to live. Britain has been in decline for a century, and many people consider it a pleasant place to live, so they shouldn't start to set their hair on fire yet. But in any case, we already see that this Donald J. Trump presidency is going to lead, obviously, to an enhanced attack on the public school system, as evidenced by the new appointment to head the Secretary of Education, that the people in charge of environmental policy have some very nasty things in mind. But therein, it seems to me, lies part of the way out. At the Marrakesh meeting on the Paris Climate Accord a few days ago, the French delegation raised the point that as the United States tries to break out of the Paris Climate Accord, there should be enhanced tariffs on U.S. exports. And interestingly enough, a day or so later, when Donald J. Trump met with the New York Times, he softened his opposition to calling climate change a Chinese hoax. I think that in that kernel, you begin to see a way out, because obviously it seems to me that particularly for black people, that speaking historically, our saving grace has been our relationship to the international community, which has withered in recent decades, not least because of this Faustian bargain that was cut with the U.S. ruling elite, which would, that is to say, in return for some civil rights concessions, we would have to throw overboard our international alliances and dump those leaders like Robeson and Du Bois who maintained those alliances. But now, with so many of our friends on the left rationalizing the Donald J. Trump victory, virtually pointing to people who voted for him as visionaries, I think we have no way out except for a global united front. And that should include, for example, sending delegations to Mexico City. Mexico will be in the crosshairs. If you look at the stock market, the entity formerly known as the Correction Corporation of America, now known as CoreCivic, and its companion in building the prison industrial complex, Geo Group, their stock has been going through the roof. That suggests not only more building of so-called immigrant detention centers, but also more attention to the prison industrial complex and more arresting of our people. And with the confusion that's rampant right now, I think that we're going to have to dance with who brung us. That is to say, go back to analyze how we got to this point, not just the point of disaster, but the point of taking meaningful steps away from first slavery, then Jim Crow. And that, of course, was through the international alliances.
Well, how did we get to this point?
Well, it's apparent that you have a structural problem in the United States. I mean, speaking as a historian, I think it starts in 1776, when you basically had a Rhodesian-style revolt or an Algerian-type revolt of settlers. Fortunately, the settlers were defeated in both Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and in Algeria, but they were victorious in the United States of America, and I think that's the seedbed of a lot of this confusion. And as noted, we were able to get out of that deep hole that was dug for us because, of course, we opposed the revolt against British rule. And most of our stalwarts have opposed U.S. settler colonialism and then U.S. imperialism. But we walked away from that after we thought that the Negro question had been settled, as it used to be prosaically called, but it was not settled. And so, therefore, you have the structural problem of a mostly retrograde Euro-American working class and middle class, and now joined by many so-called left intellectuals, particularly Euro-American left intellectuals. And now we're at the precipice of enhanced catastrophe. I mean, basically the election was between status quo neoliberalism of Hillary Rodham Clinton and counter-revolution represented by Donald J. Trump. And the vote was in favor, apparently, of counter-revolution. And that's where we stand now. Now, of course, you can make an argument that the so-called Euro-American elite mastered the art of counter-revolution abroad, Chile, 1973, assassination of Patrice Lumumba, January 1961. And in the shorthand prose, that's been interpreted to mean that the ruling elite did not share the fruits of globalization with the white masses and white working classes. And in the process, of course, the Euro-American elite had virtually liquidated the left in this country, or certainly weakened it tremendously, which then leaves the Euro-American working class and middle class with no alternative but counter-revolution at home, which is what they basically voted for. And therefore, you have a fair amount of hysteria in the elite, because when you have counter-revolution, it's like musical chairs. It's not clear if all members of the U.S. ruling elite will have a chair to sit in when the music stops. And that's part of the problem. Now, of course, what happened, if you go back even further, is that in order to blunt, if not defeat and subdue, a socialist camp and national liberation movements, the United States cut a deal with China, and in return for inward direct investment into China, China then waged war on Vietnam. It was behind the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, which led to genocide between 1975 and 1979. It was on the side of apartheid South Africa and Angola in the crisis of 1975, 1976, which, by the way, many of our folks in our community supported because they were so pro-China. But basically what happened over the decades is that China turned the tables. Instead of just being a source of cheap labor, they are now in the passing lane. And the fruits for counter-revolution and for what is euphemistically called globalization are not all being reaped by Washington and Wall Street. And as noted, they're not necessarily in a position or willing to share the fruits with the working class and the white working class and white middle class, which therefore leads to their revolt.
Yes, and of course, China now is not just a bunch of labor, but wields lots of capital.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at Apple, and by the way, you might want to dump your Apple stock. I think Apple's in a bubble. And one of the reasons is because of Xiaomi, which, of course, is producing these cheap handsets, which already has established a foothold in India, by the way, which also is rising on a sort of a Chinese model, that is to say, with a fair amount of wildly affluent people and quite a number of wildly poor people. And if you look at Hollywood, a turning point in terms of what I call the crisis of U.S. imperialism and the crisis of white supremacy, which is what the United States is enmeshed in, which has led to this Trump victory, took place just a few weeks ago in Los Angeles County Museum of Art, where China's richest man, perhaps Asia's richest man, the head of the Wanda Group, which of course controls AMC Theaters, had a meeting with Hollywood titans where they came to kiss his ring, and he laid down the law with what he wants Hollywood to do going forward, which is more China-related themes and movies, more Asian actors, more Chinese actors. And these are the same people he was talking to who just had a so-called Oscar So White campaign launched against them months ago by blacks disgusted with being shut out of the Academy Awards. And obviously, as you look at the New York Times report, this meeting did not go down very well. But it's a reflection of the present crisis of U.S. imperialism, which is simultaneously a crisis of white supremacy. And this is where we are right now.
I remember when the Reagan regime came in and folks were making comparisons to the end of Reconstruction and the impending entrance of the Ku Klux Klan, and we hear similar kinds of sounds today. What do you think in terms of any comparison to Reconstruction?
Well, I would say that the central theme of U.S. history has been counter-revolution. You can start in 1676 with Bacon's Rebellion, which, of course, some of our left friends, since it involved a revolt mostly of white masses. Anything the white masses do is ipso facto progressive and positive. It's just like Donald J. Trump says the president cannot have a conflict of interest. I mean, anything he does is obviously pure legally. Anything the white masses do is ipso facto progressive and positive, even though they were pushing London to move faster in liquidating Native Americans and enacting counter-revolution against Native American polities so that the white dispossessed could get more land. That was followed a century later by the counter-revolution of 1776. That was followed a century later by the counter-revolution of 1876. Now, Ronald Reagan was defeated in 1976 when he tried to seize the nomination from Gerald Ford, but then came to power in 1980. And I think that that's part of a counter-revolutionary process. I mean, I think, as I said, I mean, I don't necessarily think that it's inevitable and mandatory that we will have massive bloodletting legally immediately in 2017. But I think we should make no mistake about it. This is part of a counter-revolutionary process. And there's no telling where we will end.
I haven't heard the term fascist bandied about so frequently since 1969.
Well, I think the presence of Steve Bannon as the chief strategist helps us to put meat on those bones. And the so-called alt-right, to use the euphemism, which is this motley crew of white nationalists. And by the way, I think in some ways, the New York Times and the mainstream press, particularly New York Times, has done a better job of talking about identity politics than our friends on the left. The New York Times, when they talk about identity politics, even though they're all over the map, because I guess, you know, they're trying to make money, so they feel they have to appeal to different audiences. But one strain of their discourse on identity politics is white identity politics and white nationalism. Go back and look at the piece that Nell Irvin Painter, the black woman historian, wrote in the Sunday Times a couple Sundays ago. When the left talks about identity politics, they only talk about us. Whiteness is not identity politics. That's like a universal human value that's invisible. It's normalized. And I think that that's part of the problem. These people cannot get outside of themselves and do an objective analysis. Now, of course, you might say that they just want to passively be recipients of the benefits and privileges of whiteness without analyzing it. And if you look at the discourse between Kathy Franke of Columbia Law School and Mark Lila of the Columbia History Department, you get a glimpse of what I'm saying. Mark Lila of the Columbia History Department, he ran the whole identity, you know, the reason people voted for Trump was because Democrats paid too much attention to black people and gay and lesbian people, and that turned off the white working class. And then Franke says, this guy's just David Duke in an academic gown. And of course, these liberals and so-called leftists are insulted by that, but she's right. I mean, whether wittingly or not, they're doing the dirty work that's paving the way for an even deeper disaster than we face now.
The second most influential paper in the country, the Washington Post, is leading a charge and has plenty of others on in that posse against what they describe as a deep Russian state plot to influence the U.S. electorate, involving 200 websites, for example, that toe the Russian line, whatever that is.
Well, I don't take that seriously, I have to confess. I think that that's part of what led to Hillary Rodham Clinton's defeat, trying to revive the worst excesses of the Red Scare with this Moscow bashing. I mean, I think that these are the same people who told us that it was a high degree of certainty that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now they're saying it's a high degree of certainty that Russia has been intervening in the U.S. internal affairs. The Washington Post, of course, has a particular bone to pick with Donald J. Trump because he's been a war of words with Jeff Bezos, the chief stockholder of Amazon, who owns the Washington Post, suggesting that he may unleash the antitrust division of the Justice Department against Amazon. And actually, there might be a fair and legitimate case, putting aside Donald J. Trump's thin-skinned approach to politics. So that's how you have to view the Washington Post's approach to Donald J. Trump. With regard to Donald J. Trump, more specifically, I think that it's likely that, A, he will be spending quite a bit of time making money as opposed to conducting the affairs of state, that the United States is entering a realm of kleptocracy at the top that it may not have witnessed before, that there's an insider trading scandal just waiting to happen with regard to Donald J. Trump. He's probably already in the process of violating the emoluments clause of the U.S. Constitution. The bad news there is, of course, is that he's impeached. He'll be replaced by Mike Pence, who would be worse. And this means that we have to pay very close and careful attention to Donald Trump's appointees, particularly with regard to how the appointees, the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, for example, since he's probably not going to pay that much attention unless there's some profit to be made, then he'll pay attention, of course. But otherwise, he probably won't, which means that these appointees will have quite a bit of latitude. But as I said, the good news, quote unquote, is that he's going to accelerate the precipitous decline of U.S. imperialism. The bad news, of course, is that a lot of people are going to get hurt, damaged, and killed, and perhaps even imprisoned in the process. And that ominous category may include yourself and myself.
You've been thinking out loud about maybe returning to your legal profession that was your previous life instead of the public intellectual and historian that you are now. Does the Trump election, will it have any impact on your decision?
Probably in the opposite direction, because I expect the Democrats not to be able to mount an effective offensive against his judicial appointments, particularly his Supreme Court appointments, which suggests, given the age of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer and the other, and even Anthony Kennedy, the so-called swing vote, that Donald J. Trump will be able to shape the judiciary at the highest levels, and therefore legal actions off the table. That's why I'm so concerned about our leadership, because their whole strategy for the last 60 years has been based upon a deal with the U.S. ruling elite, particularly through the courts. And of course, you would have thought that with Earl Warren passing away, the former Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court some decades ago, that they would have realized that that strategy no longer obtained. I was listening to one of our civil rights leaders talking about Trump, and they were talking about trying to get the Trump Justice Department. This was the day before Senator Sessions was nominated to be Attorney General, to get them to pay more attention to federal hate crime legislation. Well, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III ain't going to be paying no attention to federal hate crime legislation except to maybe get rid of it. And so the whole strategy, it seems to me, of working with these elites through the courts has run aground. It's hit an iceberg. We need a new strategy, but I don't really see that emerging. As a matter of fact, one of the things that concerns me about this election is that many of our liberal friends, before Trump was elected, they were talking about the apocalypse would occur if he were to be elected. Now that he's been elected, many of them are trying to find the so-called silver lining, you know, trying to normalize, you know, when you get in the Oval Office, the gravity of it hits you. I remember we told the same thing about Clarence Thomas. You know, once he looked in the mirror and saw he was black, he would reverse feel. Well, I think what that realizes is that these people really have drunk the Kool-Aid. I mean, you can't say that it was a kind of opportunism in the sense that they knew what they were doing was bankrupt, but they decided to do it anyway because of profit or the like. These people really do believe what they've been telling us, which is even more frightening.
Yes, and if folks who were saying that the Ku Klux and the Nazis are at the gate were serious and actually believed it, that would call forth a different kind of response.
Well, clearly. I mean, clearly so. So, I don't know. You know, I hate to sound a note of pessimism, but it's not really pessimism because, I mean, I think there's a way out. I mean, with this global united front, for example, I mean, that should be the approach. And we should be sending delegations to Mexico City and to Beijing and to Tehran and to, or if people don't want to leave the United States because they don't have a passport, they can go to the United Nations in New York and the Organization of American States in Washington, because there's going to be a lot of opposition externally to the Trump administration. Just like, for example, a person like myself can get much more play on RT from Moscow or Press TV from Iran than from, say, the U.S. networks. And likewise, we can get more play in these foreign capitals than we can get from these squares in Washington and in New York.
And of course, seeking friends in non-domestic places is part of the black radical tradition.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. This tradition with an accent on all three words, black radical tradition, is needed more than ever. Because as I said, some of our friends on the left, my Euro-American friends, they're acting like David Duke in academic gowns. I mean, it's really ominous. It's the way that they have taken a dive. As I said, they make the people who tried to stop Trump look like chumps, and the people who voted for him look like visionaries. I mean, they've turned reality on its head.
Dr. Gerald Horn, speaking from the University of Houston.
Diana Johnstone is author of the highly acclaimed book, Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. Johnstone lives and writes in Paris, France. In a recent article, John Stone urged Clinton supporters to stop panicking and think.
I think this sort of panic and hysteria is really very childish. The fact is that there wasn't going to be a good outcome to that election anyway. You know, it was bad either way. This was more surprising, but you had two terrible candidates, so you could be prepared for that. And the question is, then what do you do? That politics isn't just an election either, a presidential election.
What some Clinton stalwarts of the more establishment kind are doing is continuing to whip up a kind of hysteria about Russia and its moles and useful idiots and allies in the United States, who they say are everywhere.
Well, that, of course, is the issue that personally upsets me the most, because I'm living in Europe. Closer to the war they want to make. And this is just, to me, it's just insanity. The idea that Russia was interfering in this election is absolutely absurd. And, you know, Putin answered that very well when he said, you know, he didn't think that the United States was a banana republic. It was a, you know, great power could defend its elections. It's incredible. And it just sounds to me like they've decided somewhere that they're going to make a war against Russia or break up Russia somehow or other. And they're all into that. I mean, the media and everything, because their hysteria against Russia isn't based on any facts. It's just become a campaign, a program. And that really disturbs me, because, you know, you have two nuclear powers, and the U.S. has always said that they would be first to use nuclear weapons. I just think that that is terribly dangerous.
Yes, and that they would think that this would be something that could gain popular support. One of the most fascinating things about this past election cycle is that the demographic that most people assumed was the most amenable to warlike noises, that is, middle American white males, didn't seem to be upset at all when Donald Trump started talking about making at least civilized talk with Russia and China, as if the war party actually doesn't have as big a demographic base as people assumed.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's this substitution of human rights, a phony human rights, instead of actually progressive internal policies that you have all over the West, that the so-called left parties have absolutely abandoned the working class and instead pretend to they're going out and saving people all over the world from their dictators. I mean, this is something for intellectuals who consider themselves on the left. And, I mean, people with just a bit of common sense can say, well, that doesn't make any sense. So it's very funny now. I mean, it's very peculiar and worrying that it's the same thing in France, that the war party is what's left of the left, and it's the conservatives who want to make peace with Russia. It's completely backwards of what you'd expect, but it's this ideological thing that the left has built up with its responsibility to protect ideology, which comes from the neoconservatives, who just use that as an excuse for conquering the world.
Yes, and folks ask, who's got a responsibility to protect us?
Well, yeah, who's going to come and protect the American people? They're not going to have, you know, some armies coming to Washington to change the regime, right? I mean, it's obvious. It's just the strong do that to the weak.
Yes, we have Trump talking about a $1 trillion program to rebuild America. Usually that's the at least rhetorical terrain of the Democrats.
Well, of course, there's a great need to build up things in the United States. Unfortunately, he doesn't say that they should stop the military spending in order to do that. That would help. Even Bernie Sanders didn't say that. But, of course, you should shift what you're building at home instead of destroying abroad. But now they're spending all their money on destruction of other countries instead of constructing their own.
Now, one would think that the Clintonites would have learned their lesson, but it does not appear that they have, in terms of understanding their own constituencies.
Well, they've sort of shifted constituencies. I mean, they think they've abandoned the working class, the industrial working class in particular, and they think that by pandering to minorities, and I do mean pandering because they don't do anything for those minorities, but they act like they're their champions, that they're going to build up along with all of the sort of certain class of loam who fall for all this human rights stuff. And it just didn't work. But I hear that they're still trying to have a recount so they can win anyway.
Why do you think the Green Party only got about 1%, maybe 2%?
Well, for one thing, people think it doesn't have a chance, you know. I just don't think it was inspiring enough.
Well, that is interesting. You're living in France now, and you were just making comparisons between the Socialist Party in France, which really is much like the Democratic Party and not very socialist at all in the United States. Given that some of the same kind of confusion or role reversal is existent in France as in the United States, I guess analysis from France by the French may lack clarity in terms of the United States, too.
Well, yeah, you know, you have this NATO policy of having the villain be Russia. And they all fall in line. And they also all fall in line to give power to financial capital. I mean, right now, you see, there's hardly any democracy left because, in fact, financial capital is setting the rules everywhere. Let's face it. And one way they do that is the European Union, which is totally devoted to making life nice for international financial capital. And that is causing a certain revolt among ordinary people who are losing their jobs and so on. But the left parties have totally bought into this. So there isn't any left. Well, there is more possibility in France simply because it's not a rigid two-party system. There is a possibility of the new left party, for instance, making some gains. Whereas in the United States, you have this rigid two-party system, and when the Democrats sell out, there's sort of no place that people can really go because, they didn't go to the Green Party, and the Green Party doesn't even, I think you can't even vote for it in all the states. So people feel it's not going to work. So at that point, so-called populists like Trump can gain working-class votes because they don't see anywhere else to go.
In the Arab world, for example, the left has been wiped out on so many times that in terms of anti-imperial thinking, there's nowhere to go in many of those societies except the right.
Yes, and of course, that explains the rise of Islamic extremism because the West has, along with Israel, has destroyed Arab nationalism, which was progressive in many ways. I mean, the last holdout is Syria of Bashar al-Assad, but they are determined to destroy that, and they will leave nothing for discontented Arabs and people in that region except to turn to religious extremism. We've brought this upon ourselves, if I may say we, meaning the West, by interfering to destroy everything progressive in the Arab world for years, for decades.
And now it comes home to roost in the United States with anti-war and populist development sentiment going to the right.
Exactly. It's the same process in a way. You systematically eliminate any left alternative for people, so they go to the nationalist right. That's the only place they can go. Or the religious right in the Middle East. It's the religious right, but it's like the only alternative that is left to people.
That was Diana Johnstone in Paris.
Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly was recently a guest on The Taylor Report, a popular political program on radio station CUIT at the University of Toronto, Canada. Kimberly was asked to describe the legacy that Barack Obama will leave behind when he exits the presidency in January.
His legacy should be one of style and image over substance. the idea of having a black president is something that people debated for decades. Would we ever see it? Could it ever happen? And then when it did, there was this outpouring, actually during the campaign after he won the Iowa caucuses and proved that he could get white people to vote for him and he could raise money. From that point on, January 2008, it was a love fest. But that's all there was to it. There was great pride in this imagery, this very powerful imagery of the presidency and the first lady. And so he was beloved. I don't think that is an exaggeration to use that word. But Obama, I had argued before he ran that we might have a black president, but we might not be very happy after we got that. Because in order to win, black people have to be thrown under the bus. Politicians make points, score points with white people by assuring them they're not going to do anything for black people. And he was no exception. In 2004, he gave a speech at the Democratic convention where John Kerry was nominated. That's the year he ran for the Senate. And he was allowed to give this speech in prime time, which was big. And he said, there is no black America. There is no white America. And he was going on to say there is only one America. But that words like that are very telling. He made it clear from the beginning he was not going to do anything to fulfill the special needs and distinct needs that black people have in this country. Whenever he was asked about black unemployment or any issue involving black people, his answer was always the same. The rising tide lifts all boats. I'm the president of the whole country, so if I can help the economy, it helps everybody. But there was never any intention, never any effort to do something that would help us in any particular way. And we do have particular needs. We needed a bigger stimulus program that would produce jobs. There are places like Detroit, Michigan, and New Orleans, Louisiana, which are in great need of government help, where people are desperately poor. Detroit was driven into bankruptcy by the banks, by the way, who ended up getting paid first, but that's another story. The people in Flint, Michigan, whose water was poisoned with lead, he didn't do anything. That was as late as this year. He visited Flint for a photo op. He drank some water. He said, I feel fine, and maybe I got some lead as a kid, and I turned out okay. He could get away with saying insulting things about black people, which gave white people a message that he would not in any way upset the status quo as far as what they could always expect should happen, or rather should not happen for black people. So that has been his legacy. But it was all very hollow, the love for him. There were people who came out to vote in 2008 who either had not voted in years or who had never voted at all, just to see him become president. And one of the reasons Donald Trump will be inaugurated instead of Hillary Clinton is that those people who were so disengaged, who didn't vote before 2008, went right back to not voting when they couldn't vote for him again. And there was no plan. And one of the reasons I blame the Democratic Party for this loss, there was never any plan to engage those people. Well, first of all, you engage people by delivering, by doing something for them, but no plan to keep some of their votes, nothing. Just Obama giving speeches saying, if you care about my legacy, you'll vote for Hillary, which you can't transfer one person's popularity to another. He told jokes about he made up this character, Cousin Pookie, and he'd always say when he wanted black people to vote, tell Cousin Pookie to get to the polls, which is something a white person couldn't get away with. So the Cousin Pookie jokes and what about my legacy comments, that was what passed for outreach in the Democratic Party. And that's why Hillary Clinton received 6 million fewer votes than he did in 2012. That's one of the reasons why, and why Donald Trump is going to be the president and not her. So his attitude toward black people was very dismissive. There was no desire to engage people. And that led to fewer votes, and it led to this crazy electoral college system whereby someone can get more electoral votes but lose popular votes and still win. so this is Hillary Clinton's defeat is the result of many things, but in large part because of the hollowness of that relationship.
That was Margaret Kimberly on the Taylor Report from Toronto. For the 47th year in a row, over 1,000 Native Americans and their allies gathered in Plymouth, Massachusetts last Thursday for the annual Native American National Day of Mourning. Nellie Bailey was there covering the event for Black Agenda Report. But the commanding presence in Plymouth was political prisoner Leonard Peltier, the American Indian Movement activist who's been behind bars for 41 years. Native American elder Bert Waters read Peltier's statement to the crowd.
Here we are again. This time, the year is 2016. It has been more than 41 years since I last walked free and was able to see the sun rise and set and felt the feel of free earth beneath my feet. I know there have been more changes than I can even imagine out there. But I do know that there is a struggle taking place as to whether this country will move on to a more sustainable way of life. This is something we wanted to have happened back in the 70s. I watched the events at Standing Rock with both pride and sorrow. Pride that our people and their allies are standing up and putting their lives on the line for the coming generations. Not because they want to, but because they have to. They are right to stand up in a peaceful way. It is the greatest gathering of our people in history and has made us more connected than ever before. We need to support each other as we stand our way in these times. Water is life. Water is life. And we cannot leave this issue for our children and grandchildren to deal with when things are far worse for the natural world than they are now. And Mother Earth is always in struggle. And I feel sorrow for the water protectors at Standing Rock, because these last few days have been brought a much harsher response from the law enforcement agencies. And our people are suffering. At least they are finally getting attention of the national media. My home is in North Dakota. The Standing Rock people are my people. Sitting Bull lies in his grave there at Fort Yates. My home is Turtle Mountain. It's just a few hours north of Standing Rock, just south of Manitoba, Canada. I have not seen my home since I was a boy, and I still hold out hope of returning there for whatever time I may have left. It is the land of my father, and I would like to be able to live there again and before I die. I have a different feeling this year. The last time I felt this way was 16 years ago, when I last had a real chance for freedom. It is an uneasy feeling, an unsettling one. It is a hard thing to allow hope to creep into my heart and my spirit here in these cold buildings of stone and steel. On one hand, to have hope is joyful and wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. But the downside of it is, for me, there can be no anything crueler than this. But today I will choose hope. I pray that you will all enjoy good health and good feelings. And I thank all of you from the bottom of my heart for all you have done and continue to do for me and for our Mother Earth. Please keep me in your prayers and thoughts as these last days of 2016 slip away. I send you my love and my respect for all of you who have gathered in the name of stand with your spirit, Buster, in the spirit of Crazy Horse. Let it come here.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.